gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I am pretty under the weather, but I was going to postpone recording this until tomorrow, which I would prefer to do, but then I realized, what if I feel worse tomorrow? And even if I'm generally on the mend tomorrow, when I have colds, I feel worse in the mornings. And that's when I would have to record it. So I'm just going to give it a whirl. And if I start speaking in tongues, or if the turtle with Johnny Cash's voice just keeps telling me to find my soulmate and I get distracted, I apologize. If you don't know the reference, I don't know what to tell you. I got nothing burning, no burning desire to talk about anything. Bees in my bonnet. I think I've talked enough about the editorial. I generally think we should let our editorial speak for themselves. We recorded a dispatch pod this morning and we talked about TikTok. There's this William F. Buckley Society thing at Yale. Every year they bring students to Washington, D.C. They're very impressive young people. Almost every year, I think, or I don't know, last couple of years at least, just had lunch with them. They were asking me about what I thought about J.D. Vance, who they met with earlier this week. And, you know, I didn't say it this way, but it was basically like, well, which J.D. Vance, the guy he's become or the guy he was? At least that's what was in my head. What actually came out of my mouth was probably more vituperative. But it led to this point about TikTok. So, like, I've made this point for a very long time now that Trumpism and Trump really shouldn't be understood or analyzed through an ideological prism, but through a psychological or sociological prism. And that's because there is no coherent philosophical perspective to Trumpism. And in a weird way, if you were going to pay a much bigger compliment than I'm prepared to do, you would say that if there was a school of political thought that Trump adhered to or was inspired by or operated, you know, within the tradition of, I think you'd say American pragmatism, you know, this sort of broad notion that one person's intellect, in Trump's case, his instincts, because he talks so much about how his instincts are so good, can figure out the truth of something without consulting experts, data, facts, reason, arguments, or anything like that. And this sort of touches on my longstanding thing that I think the most interesting figurative debate, I don't think it was a real debate, most interesting figurative debate of the 20th century wasn't between Hayek and Keynes, which, you know, has the great rap video and all that kind of stuff, and is an interesting thing, although, like, it gets pretty weedy on the economics. The most interesting sort of philosophical divide of the 20th century was really between Hayek and John Dewey, because John Dewey sort of is one of the avatars of American philosophical pragmatism, which basically says an expert can, you know, a disinterested progressive expert can grok out the right policy better than the market, better than merely, you know, letting the animal spirits figure things out. That, you know, this is sort of the argument behind drift and mastery. You know, do you take control? Do you take the reins of society and you guide it towards specific ends using, you know, your engineering and other skills? Or do you just let things work themselves out, create a framework, you know, a rule of law, market-based framework kind of thing? You know, one of my favorite lines about life comes from, and certainly of politics, comes from Calvin Coolidge, who was, you know, one of the major figures of this era where this debate was unfolding about American pragmatism and markets versus statism and whatnot. And he has this great line where he says, if you see 10 problems rolling towards you, if you do nothing, 9 of them will fall off the road and roll into a ditch on their own. And I generally think that's true. Right? If you look at, you know, everyone likes to catastrophize about all the problems that we face, but if you go back at any 10-year period and you look at what people were saying was the signature terrifying issue that was going to determine the future and ruin things for everybody, and most of the time those issues kind of went away. And sometimes they went away because the, you know, society did something about them, but sometimes they just went away on their own accord because the sort of animal spirits of the society were at work. Okay, this is a huge distraction, and it's definitely a cold medicine rapid hole that I'll pull myself out of. Anyway, I got onto this because, like, Donald Trump does not have a coherent political philosophy. He has a few consistent positions, like he thinks that protectionism is smart. He's convinced that other countries pay the tariffs rather than American consumers, which he's just wrong about. Has views on immigration that I think are right. I shouldn't say are right, but that are consistent, that he's had for a very long time. Some of his views on immigration are in the vicinity of right. How he expresses them and how he would implement them, I think, are much more debatable. I think there's a consistent line in him that could be called realist, where he basically thinks American exceptionalism is a stupid idea. He overturns the traditional conservative critique of Washington by saying it's run by stupid people who don't know how to use power, rather than the way the normal conservative critique was, that it was smart people who were using power badly towards unconservative ends. He's completely comfortable with the idea of state power. And I think some of that just comes from his sort of desire to be a strong man or appear like a strong man, and his strong man envy and yada, yada, yada. And also, I think he thinks the presidency is basically like being mayor of New York City. And I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for it. But the point is that he is perfectly happy to change positions anytime he feels like it. He thinks he can read the room. He thinks he has this great political timing. He thinks he has these great political instincts. I could go back and find all the quotes where he's said various versions of this. He even goes so far as to have this romantic notion that, like, his mood actually affects reality in some way, and including his net worth. What he calls, you know, his reliance on his instinct and all of that is better sometimes just simply understood as laziness. He just doesn't really want to put in the work to figure things out. So he'd rather just sort of say, I have this oracular power to figure things out in the moment. Because his ego is such that he is incapable of admitting that he was wrong, he can just say, you know, of course it was the right decision. It's this tautology, right? If he made the decision, then it's the right decision. And it's brilliant because he made it. And so there's really no reason to sort of rethink his process. And one of the amazing things about Trump is that he's basically like he's the millionth monkey who successfully banged out, Shakespeare on a typewriter. Because he violates all sorts of norms and rules about how to behave in business and in life. And normally the consequences of those kinds of violations are really negative, but he's the statistical outlier, right? He's the kind of example that you get with the laws of large numbers, that sometimes, you know, the monkey writes Shakespeare or throws darts at three, you know, fantastic growth stocks or whatever, right? I mean, that's the distribution of things sometimes. And he is, and because he has winner's bias, he thinks that he was like super smart in all of his decisions and filters out all of the bad decisions and the consequences of those. And so in other words, he's just simply mercurial and inconsistent. And so, which brings me back to TikTok. Now, I think there are basically, there are very few good arguments, I want to be clear. I keep falling into this trap of talking about the TikTok ban, and it is not a TikTok ban. It is a mandate that a foreign company heavily influenced by the Chinese Communist Party divest itself of a platform in the United States. And if they refuse to do that, then that platform will be barred from being used in the United States. In other words, if TikTok ends up getting banned, it's going to be China's fault, because China is saying that it would rather shut the thing down than allow it to be sold to an American company, which creates all sorts of problems because with their arguments and other defenses of TikTok, because they also claim that it's independent from China and that China really doesn't have any say over it. But they're also saying that China's also saying that we'll rather shut it down than let it be sold, and that it can't be disentangled from, you know, its Chinese network connections, even though it's supposed to be independent from China, right? I mean, they keep having trying to have it both ways. And so I think there are very, very, very few even plausible arguments against this legislation that would force the divestment. There are even fewer that I think are actually made in good faith. I guess I can talk about that, but like, I just, you know, there are no First Amendment issues that really obtain here. This is about a platform. It's not targeted at specific speech. We do not allow foreign governments to own much less significant media platforms in the United States. Like, you know, the British would be allowed to buy an American television station. Never mind, you know, Russia or China or Cuba or Saudi Arabia or anything like that. This was just sort of an accepted, settled part of American law for a very long time. It's like, you know, when big multinationals would want to do mergers, sometimes they would have to divest themselves of some media holdings so they didn't run afoul of the SEC stuff. When you have tens of millions of people getting their news from TikTok, it seems utterly reasonable to say that, you know, it can't be run by an adversarial foreign power. And people say, well, you know, it's not like the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party is making a news show on TikTok. No, that's true. But they are curating it in a way with, you know, an algorithm that fronts stuff that furthers Chinese interests in terms of the global news environment, Chinese national priorities. You know, lots of stuff about how the West is terrible and Israel is terrible, and look at the plight of the poor Palestinians. But try to find a lot of stuff about Uyghurs or Tibetans or Hong Kong or non-Han Chinese in China on TikTok, and good luck. I mean, I'm sure you can find a little of it. They keep saying that they've improved all that stuff, but whenever you look at the actual data, it's pretty obvious that the algorithm is curated in consonance with, you know, the interests of the Chinese Communist Party. But even if it weren't, even if they've tapped that down a little bit for political expediency, given the nature of this debate, you still have the fact that the thing is a threat to national security. You know, I mean, I remember making this point when last time I had Colin Kitchen on here. What's his Bob Manafort, the guy who was briefly the Trump campaign advisor. One of the things that, you know, he got in legal jeopardy for was giving some confidential polling to some Russian oligarch or something. Now, maybe that was kind of overcharged. I'm not sure. It always seemed to me like a little bit of a stretch. But like, if that kind of information or data about America is considered verboten to give over to a foreign adversary, having tens of millions of essentially data mining monitors running around wild in the United States of America in terms of the TikTok app, it seems to be pretty obvious that that data collection is far more serious and far more worrisome. You know, we talk about this on the Dispatch podcast, but like, you know, so critics of TikTok, you know, the Mike Gallagher crowd, who, you know, I like a lot, they'll talk about how this is the potential for a massive influence operation by a Chinese, you know, by the Chinese Communist Party against the United States of America. And that having this level of influence, particularly over young people, is not good for the United States of America. And again, side note to a side note to a side note, China flat out bans anything like Twitter, Facebook, anything American owned comparable to TikTok in the United States. China just flat out bans it. In fact, the version of TikTok in China doesn't have anything near the liberty that the one in America does. Like there, it's much more curated for how to turn young Chinese people into obedient citizens of the state, servants of the state. You don't get sex, drugs, and rock and roll or politics or anything like that. You get, you know, exciting videos about how awesome it is to do your homework, you know, and to study, you know, Xi Jinping's political thought and that kind of thing. And so it's really hard to take these Chinese mouthpieces talking about how disturbing it is the United States of America would crap crack down on, you know, expression or business freedom or any of these sorts of things when they don't allow anything like any of that in their own country. There's no reciprocity here. We're supposed to be totally cavalier about Chinese companies operating freely in the United States, including companies that are potentially real threats like TikTok. But how dare you suggest that outside companies have anything like that kind of freedom inside of China? It's just, it's ridiculous on its face. These were some of the arguments that led Donald Trump in, what, 2019 to push for exactly this, the divestment of TikTok from ByteDance or, you know, whatever. And that was the Trump administration position. And so places like the Heritage Foundation, which I think has been selling little chunks of its soul and its integrity for years now, piecemeal, they got into this fight against TikTok. And, you know, in part, this, you know, stems in part from the work that Klon did when he was still at Heritage. And good for them. I agree with the arguments. I agree with the policy. But, like, I guarantee you that, like, it would have been a more nuanced thing for Heritage if Trump hadn't laid out a marker that this was actually his position, particularly since this new president came in and at Heritage. And so, you know, they went all in. They invested the time and the resources and the arguments to do the policy research and to make the case against TikTok. And again, I agree with them for the most part. I mean, I haven't studied all of their stuff on this, but I generally, they're in favor of this legislation, and so am I. But lo and behold, all it takes is for some super libertarian donor who's a big investor in TikTok to go meet with Trump in Mar-a-Lago. And probably, I think those guys figured out the best argument to use on Trump was to say getting rid of TikTok would be bad for Mark Zuckerberg. And boom, Trump changes his position on this, not based on any arguments about national security, not based on any arguments, at least according to his public statements, right, on anything having to do with a change in the policy or factual environment from his position in 2019. It's just that, you know, and now he's really pissed at Mark Zuckerberg, or as he calls him, Schmuckerberg, and some donors got in his ear about this stuff. And maybe he sees some political advantage to get on the other side of this with Biden. That's possible too. But he's changed his position based upon no new facts, new evidence, new arguments, nothing of substance or merit that I have seen from anyone. You know, places like the Heritage Foundation are now left holding a bag of crap, because all it takes for big slices of the sort of MAGA populist universe of boosters and sycophants to say, well, Trump changed his position, so we have to too. And it's been really kind of wild to watch some of the crazy ass populist nonsense arguments from the, you know, Trump is always right crowd, from people who were invested in the old position, in part because it was Trump's position, in part maybe because it was the right position. But regardless, now they're saying, well, you know, yeah, no, China shouldn't have this control, but neither should the Biden regime, and yada, 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 yada. And you know, Rand Paul is just, as usual, mixing craven nonsense with, you know, flavoring, you know, of principle on the outside. I mean, it's sort of like he, you know, has like principle MSG, right? Which he just sort of shakes on his garbage arguments. And because he says First Amendment a lot, people are always like, oh, he must really care about the First Amendment. Like, garbage. I remember seeing Vivek Ramaswamy's argument the other day, but like, you know what? How invested Vivek was in the China as a national security threat to the United States stuff. And now it's sort of like, eh, whatevs. Although he was sort of talking about, he's been talking about both sides of his mouth about TikTok for a long time. And this is sort of the problem with trying to come up with philosophically coherent ideologies or theories about Trump and Trumpism, is that if you try to construct a ideologically coherent and consistent moral and political philosophical framework around Trump, at some point, you're going to be stuck having to decide, are you going to be loyal to Trump or are you going to be loyal to the intellectual legwork that you've been doing for a long time? And for the most part, push comes to shove, particularly the closer you get to the actual political arena, most of these people tend to abandon their intellectual project in order to be loyal. And that's how you get this sort of, I think this is one of the main drivers of this, of the fact that like the safe harbor for Trump isn't to invest at all in ideas or principles or philosophy. It's simply to say, I trust Trump's instincts. Because that way, whatever he does, you can still be on his side. And I think this is one of the things that has caused such havoc to the intellectual and philosophical integrity of vast swaths of the right, is this basic maneuver of having no principled safe place, no, you know, base of operations that, you know, safe harbor. People end up being driven into an effect, a cult of personality thing, because that's the only, when you have someone who zigzags and reverses themselves all the time, whether it's on abortion or whatever, or healthcare or taxes or COVID or, you know, go down a long list. The only way to stay on his good side and the side of his super fans is just simply say, I trust dear leader. And it's his decisions, and he knows more than I do, and his instincts are right. And it's just fundamentally un- and anti-intellectual, which is what populism is un- and anti-intellectual.
Okay, so let's take a second to hear from our sponsor, Aura Frames. Longtime listeners know I'm a big fan of Aura Frames. I've gotten them as gifts. I've given them as gifts. I sent my daughter back to college with one so she could look at many, many, many pictures of her cat and I guess her parents as well. So if you're looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life, Aura Frames are a beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. I can attest, it is very easy to use, very intuitive. You don't have to read a lot of documentation. It's just like you load the app and it says, what pictures do you want in your frame? And you put them in your frame and you can change them and you can set the settings to whatever you want for how long the pictures stay there. It's pretty idiot proof. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, A-U-R-A, Frames.com. Use the promo code REMNANT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
So, I know people don't like to hear about Twitter, but like the bots are coming out with greater and greater urgency and frequency. And it's interesting sometimes to see where the lines are. And also because, you know, social media is heavily mimetic, you know, bots put a whole bunch of garbage out there and then easily led normal humans ape the language. And then the bots can kind of disappear because the talking points have already been incepted out there. So I've been accused a lot these days of being a warmonger, a war pig, which I think is one of the signs that this was a bot account, at least the first few people who used that phrase at me, because I suspect that there's like a term in Russia or Russian or Chinese or some other language where war pig means sort of glutton for war, warmonger, or that kind of stuff. But to my knowledge, it doesn't have that meaning in the United States and in U.S. English. I mean, I Googled around, you know, war pigs. You could find stuff about some band or whatever, and you can find stuff about like pigs who fought in war and whatnot. But like this phrase, like chicken hawk is an American phrase, right? You know, and warmonger is kind of an American phrase. But war pig to mean chicken hawk or warmonger is new to me. And I've been getting called these names for a very long time. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. There are a whole bunch of people who think that including the Pope, alas, who's not a bot, Taylor Swift is a robot, but that's a different argument. But there's argument that somehow if you hate war, you should be in favor of Ukraine coming to the negotiating table, you know, raising the white flag, as the Pope said. I get the argument, although it's often not really an argument so much as a sentiment in the form of an argument. But, you know, I mean, what started this whole sort of assault on me was I was like, so Putin said in an interview that just because Ukraine is running out of ammunition, that would be a really silly reason to start negotiating. I pointed out acerbically that all of the sort of Putin lickspittles and apologists and other goobers who have been trying to tell me that Putin's really interested and Russia's really interested in peace and that Ukraine is the holdup can go stuff it, because like, this is not the position. It's the position. It's a serious position. It's a correct position from Putin's, you know, mindset about a war, you know, is that when you have an advantage, you press your advantage in a war. And merely because you're exhausting the other side's resources is not a reason to sort of be forced to the negotiating table. I'm not the one who's been saying that the Russians just really want peace and that if we could just give them these eastern provinces of Ukraine, that would be fine with Putin. And that's all he really wants, is he wants to protect the Russian-speaking people. Elon Musk was prattling on about this garbage recently. And it's just not true, right? He's also, he and his mouthpieces on state TV have been saying all sorts of stuff about how, you know, Poland and Finland should get nervous and that Ukraine should be erased because it's not really a country and needs to be completely absorbed into Russia, which again is much closer to the actual meaning of genocide, according to the UN, than anything Israel is doing in Gaza. And that's the thing, is that if you actually don't want more war, you should want Ukraine to win. You should want Ukraine, and like immediately, as night follows day, whenever I make these kinds of arguments, someone says, well, why don't you get up and go fight? And I was like, it's a non sequitur, right? It's an attempt to shut people down from making a much more mainstream, normal point. Ukraine wants to fight. It wants to keep fighting. It wants to eject Russian forces from its soil. They're not asking Americans to come and fight for them. All they're asking for is the wherewithal to fight it themselves. And so this saying, well, why don't you just go fight with them thing is just stupid bullying and nothing more. And I just, you know, it just slides off me. It's a logical non sequitur. It's really dumb, but it's really common out there. Anyway, if you want to have less war, you need to increase the price of war for the people pursuing war. If it's really easy for Putin to take Ukraine, he will not stop at Ukraine. Now, it hasn't been easy so far, so there's been some price that's been put on it. But if the lesson is all Putin has to do, or all any aggressor invading state needs to do, is wait for Western resolve to buckle, wait for supplies to dry out, and then you win. The takeaway lesson from that for the Russians is, okay, we need to do better planning in the initial invasion part, but we know at the end of the day, so long as we stick to our guns, literally, we'll win. And the West will cave and essentially reward Putin's criminal behavior. I do not think this is a particularly insightful or brilliant observation. I just think it's true and kind of obvious. If Russia is pushed back to its original, you know, its pre-invasion borders, pre-2014, pre-Crimea, or pre, you know, 2022, if you want to talk about that, I mean, whatever. But if it's pushed back, if it's seen as an obvious failure, it is much harder for Putin or whoever his successor would be to launch another war. If Putin wins and conquers Ukraine, it will be seen as a big success, and successes like that breed more successes. So if you want to deter more war, make the current war such a poison pill that no one says, hey, that looks like a great idea. That's why China is following this so closely. is, you know, they definitely want to take Taiwan. They're planning on taking Taiwan. If they take the lesson from the invasion of Ukraine, that sure, it's some hassle up front, but at the end of the day, the West will say it's not our problem and you can have it. That makes it more likely for them to invade and take over Taiwan. I just don't see how that this is a controversial point. And so the people who are saying Ukraine needs to swallow the bitter pill and come to the negotiating table with under the white flag and sign off big chunks of its own country, they're the ones who want more war. Now, they may not realize it, and some of these people are just bots or whatever, or sheeple and whatever. But like that argument, the anti-war argument is the more is will lead to more war. The anti-war argument is actually pro-war in a lot of ways. Oh, I've been meaning to write about it. I've been meaning to talk about it. Our friends over at the Institute, let me see if I can call it up. Institute for the Study of War. You know, this is the, to be honest, I don't completely understand its relationship to AI. A lot of AI people also do ISW, but ISW is kind of a separate center offsite from us. Fred Kagan, obviously, is one of the leading lights of it. And as you know, I think Fred does great work. Anyway, they have this report that came out last month that I've linked to a few times and I keep wanting to talk about. I think it's called, The Kremlin's Occupation Playbook, Coerced Russification and Ethnic Cleansing in Occupied Ukraine. And if you go to the ISW website, understandingwar.org, you'll find it pretty quickly. Just search for, Russification or whatever. One of the things it gets into in the report is Russia's ongoing kidnapping of thousands of Ukrainian children and deprogramming and brainwashing of Ukrainian children. It doesn't get anything near the morally required coverage in the West. It's complicated and it's messy kind of story to cover. Russia claims that it's basically helping these kids, taking them from war-torn places and bringing them to these wonderful camps and placing them with families. But this is genocidal. This is like actually what, like one of the prerequisites or one of the definitions of genocide, according to the UN, is taking children and essentially psychologically ethnically cleansing them. And that's what Russia is doing. And Russia has done this many times in the past, right? You got to remember that Russian nationalism and notions of Russification are not biologically racist. They're much more about language and culture. Russia's not alone in this approach to things. You know, it was like there's a lot of this in the Ottoman Empire, but they're taking kids, making it very difficult for their parents in Ukraine or in occupied Ukraine to know where they are or how they're doing, and they're programming them to be Russians. And it is so grotesque, and it just gets none of the attention that it deserves. And anyway, maybe I'll have one of the authors on to talk about this stuff, but this is one of these things that my dad always used to talk about how about these kinds of Russian tactics and Soviet tactics that just were so ugly that a lot of the Western press just felt it was too gross or too complicated or there's too much cognitive dissonance to actually provide the evidence that the evil empire was an evil empire. But the things that Russia is doing, the things that Russia is allowing in terms of rape and torture and all that is so grotesque. It's like everything that that Hamas did in Israel on October 7th is permissible basically by Russian troops. And in fact, I don't know where it stands, but I assume it's passed early in the war in the Duma. They passed legislation saying that Russian soldiers could not be charged with war crimes for their behavior in Ukraine. Basically, just a total permission structure to do evil. If you want less of that, you should make it really expensive for Russia to do it. And that will have a demonstration effect for other countries as well. The idea that, you know, and this gets to the Hamas stuff too, the idea that the ceasefire, the pro-peace position, is so grotesque to me. Look, I get, we talked about this a lot with Dan Senor, I get being horrified by the image that are coming out of Gaza. I often want to, it's so tempting to do whataboutism. You know, why weren't these people horrified by, I would argue, at least as bad, if not worse, images from Syria, from what Assad was doing and all that? There is this sort of selection bias about it's that somehow it's supposed to be, because they're Jews, you're supposed to be really outraged. But when Arabs kill Arabs, well, that's just what Arabs do or something. And anyway, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But the first thing to point out is that the hardcore, what do you want to call them, pro-Hamas or pro-Palestinian or anti-Israel, that crowd, the crowd that started protesting on October 7th against Israel, they were for a ceasefire before there was fire, right? I mean, it took a while for Israel to respond militarily almost at all, save to, like, kill the handful of rapists and kidnappers who were still findable on Israeli soil. That kind of thing was still going on. But in terms of a coordinated military response, that didn't happen for a while. And already people were calling for a ceasefire. Or at the time, I guess a lot of them were saying, calling against any further escalation. Don't do anything escalatory. Don't really, you know, basically don't respond. And again, I don't like talking about this in the language of economics, but the things that you subsidize, you get more of. The things that you tax, you get less of. If you don't impose a cost on barbaric pogroms where people are raped and murdered and tortured and kidnapped, and it's not just the people who died, right? And it's not just the people who were kidnapped. There are a few thousand people who were horribly wounded, and there are, you know, many more sort of displaced. Like, Israel has an obligation to respond to that in a way that makes that kind of thing prohibitively expensive for its enemies, particularly when people forget in the first days and weeks after October 7th, you had Hamas leaders going on TV saying, we're going to do it again and again and again. There are going to be many October 7ths. This is just the first one. And we're going to do it until we utterly destroy Israel. Now, you can not like Israel. You can say Israel shouldn't be there. I think I'm pretty clear on how I think most of those arguments are garbage. A lot of them are anti-Semitic, but not all of them. Some of them are just stupid. But the fact is, it is there. And if you're willing to make the argument that Palestinians have no choice but to do violence as an act of resistance, blah, 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 then you have to sort of accept the exact same logic that Israelis have no choice but to respond to these things. As I started recording, there was all this stuff about how Schumer called out Bibi Netanyahu by name and said he doesn't have the confidence and wants a new election in Israel, and how there's all this talk about how the Biden administration basically considers going into Rafah a red line. And I want to be clear about this, right? There are a lot of objections that I have to this. But first of all, I think Israel has every right to go into Rafah, has every right to root out Hamas there. I think it would be better rather than, you know, it would be preferable if they did it in a way to minimize as many casualties as possible while still achieving their military objectives. But the extent civilians in Rafah would die, which I think, again, would be regrettable. I think the moral culpability for that is still with Hamas. Hamas could have surrendered on October 8th, and there would have been no war. Could have done it on October 9th, October 10th, October 11th. They could have surrendered and given up the hostages, and all the people who insist that only Israel has the moral and military agency and political agency to stop this thing, and that they have a unilateral obligation to declare a ceasefire. They could have gotten a ceasefire if Hamas just gave up. And no one entertained this idea. No one said, you know, all right, well, you can't expect them all to surrender, but they could release the hostages and blah, 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 blah. I really don't like, you know, the rhetoric that says that if you're anti-Israel, you're pro-Hamas, and I don't think that's the case for a good number of people. But for another large number of people, not to sound too Marxist, but like it is objectively true that their arguments and their preferred policies are pro-Hamas. If you want fewer Israeli incursions into Palestinian areas, and if you want to see fewer gang rapes and mass slaughters of old people and children, you should be for Israel finishing the job with Hamas. The moral bullying that says that if you're not in favor of letting Hamas off the mat, or really letting Hamas get away with it for the people who said that Israel shouldn't respond in the first place, you're the ones who want more October 7ths. You're the ones who want Israel to declare more wars that kill more civilian Palestinians, because no nation state can be expected to tolerate that kind of thing. And so, look, I don't know enough about the facts on the ground. I don't know if, like, the payoff of going into Rafah is as big as the geopolitical costs. And even if I think those geopolitical costs are unfair and unwarranted, they're still real. I don't know, you know, if the cost-benefit analysis works. If the Israelis think that they can take out the last couple brigades of Hamas and take out the last few, you know, leaders of Hamas who are in situ with a minimal loss of life, then they should absolutely do it. And screw the Biden administration for saying that they shouldn't. Screw Chuck Schumer for saying that they shouldn't. And, you know, I hate the sort of taking the sides of foreign countries against your own political leadership, but like, this is one of my problems with what Biden is doing, is it's just bad policy and it's bad politics. All of the goodwill that he accrued for, you know, getting Israel's back is dissipating rapidly. And it's not only dissipating here, it's dissipating in Israel too. And sending the signal that we lack resolve, which is what Biden is doing in both Ukraine and in Israel, that we, you know, our basic fundamental national security geostrategic interests have not changed very much since Russia invaded Ukraine or since October 7th of last year. What has changed a great deal are the signals that this administration is sending about how reliable we are as an ally. And that's another thing. If you want less war, you have to send the signal that America is a reliable ally, that we honor our commitments, that when we say we're with Ukraine for as long as it takes, that means more than the second half of a president's administration until you get close to an election. And I have absolute contempt for Republicans and Democrats on this stuff. The argument I get from a lot of people was, you know, well, if Democrats were only willing to support strengthening the border, we wouldn't be in this situation. As a matter of punditry and political analysis, I think that's pretty flawed, but let's just sort of accept that it's true. You're no friend of Ukraine, which a lot of Republicans still claim to be, if you make the linkage. If you say, we're not going to help Ukraine unless we get this stuff for the border. I get the political argument, but don't tell me about what a great friend to Ukraine you want to be if you insist that you're not going to help Ukraine unless you get what you want for domestic political purposes. Forcing the linkage was a betrayal of Ukraine. I think refusing to vote on the border bill. I understand. I have a lot of good friends, former colleagues at NR, who think that border compromise thing was just a disastrously bad piece of legislation. I just, every time I hear them explain it, I just don't see the evidence for it. I really don't. I mean, could it have been better? Absolutely. Is Rich Lowry right that the smarter play for Republicans would have been to just vote to give Biden the authority to do whatever he wanted at the border, and then when he didn't do it, hold him accountable for it? Yeah, I think that's a great political strategy. But for the Democrats who claim to be great friends of Ukraine, they shouldn't have played those games either, right? But at least they were calling Republicans bluff, and the Republicans have said, you know, okay, this is how we're going to get help to Israel and Ukraine. Chickened out because, again, Donald Trump doesn't care about policy. He cares about having issues. And so all these people who stuck their necks out trying to develop a sort of an argument for how to get a strong border enforcement bill passed, again, we're holding bags of shit because of Trump's utter disregard for the actual national security policy stuff. He just wants to be able to have the talking points. You know, it's like what he told the Ukrainians, just allege that Biden did something corrupt and we'll do the rest. Or when he told the Justice Department, just say you're investigating irregularities and evidence of the stolen election and we'll do the rest. He just needs the talking point because he's a condo salesman. And people like James Langford, who has a lot of integrity and a lot of moral seriousness and a lot of policy seriousness, he got hung out to dry because he actually cared about doing something about the problem rather than just playing the kabuki of providing the issues and the narrative and the framing and all the nonsense. Again, I think there are people who sincerely believe, like the J.D. Vance position, which I think is garbage, on Ukraine. But I just know that a lot of them don't believe it. And the willingness to play these games because they think it will curry favor with Trump, or because, you know, the narrative, you know, maintenance squads of Fox News or the Federalist or wherever said that, you know, the fatwa went out that this is the position you have to take, even if you don't believe it's to be true. They're doing profound damage to the country, to the and again, the policy supporting you. I'm happy to stipulate for argument's sake. I don't agree with it, but I'm happy to stipulate for argument's sake that the policy of helping Ukraine is wrong. Right? Okay. Like Michael Brennan Doherty comes to that position honestly. To one extent or another, he does not, you know, every time I don't take the bait and, you know, skewer Michael for his positions and accuse him of bad faith. I get a lot of nasty email from people saying, you know, he's just a Putin apologist. He's not, at least, you know, I don't see the evidence of it. I've had conversations with him in private and in public. He's not a fan of Putin. He thinks that what Putin did was grotesque. But he also thinks that this is like what you would expect from Russia, full stop, even if it wasn't Putin. And he thinks NATO enlargement was a mistake. And there are principled arguments there. Again, I don't really subscribe to them, but fine, whatever. So you can make the argument that supporting Ukraine and saying we're with them for as long as it takes was a bad policy. But we issued the policy. We made the assurance. We declared that to the world. And it's sort of, you know, I think I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, but like, you know, Charles Lindbergh was a huge critic of getting into World War II. He had that horrible speech at Madison Square Garden. He wasn't the anti-Semite that some people claim he was, although, you know, I'm not saying he had great views on Jews. There's just not a lot of evidence that he was like this virulent anti-Semite. What he was a passionate Germanophile or Teutonophile. He just was tumescent with ardor and lust and admiration for Germany. And he didn't want us to go to war with it. And he thought it was a bad idea. But once we went to war, he begged FDR to let him enlist. And FDR wouldn't let him do it. Right? Taft was a non-interventionist. I don't think he was the isolationist, some people call him, but okay, call him an isolationist. He was definitely against getting into the UN, had, you know, views on World War II and on the Korean War that, you know, were philosophically consistent. But once the fighting started, he was like, we got to win. Once you make a commitment to an ally that we're with them to the hilt for as long as it takes, the adversary of our ally starts making alliances too, which is what Putin has done with China and Iran and North Korea. They've expanded, as political scientist E.E. Schachtschneider had this great phrase, expanding the scope of conflict. Putin expanded the scope of conflict to bring in allies for his supply chains. And in response to our promises that we were going to be the arsenal of democracy for Ukraine. if all it takes is but 2 years and change for us as a nation, forget a president or a party or anything like that, as a nation to renege on those insurances, who is going to rely on our assurances in the near future again or in the far-flung future? If you want less war, you need to have credible deterrent. And part of credible deterrent is being a staunch ally to the people you say you're going to be an ally to. And, you know, there's already talk in Europe. Francis Dernley was talking about this on the Telegraph podcast about how it's now increasingly foreseeable that you might see a kind of small alliance or entente of frontline nations, you know, like Poland and the Baltics and who knows who else, who form their own sub-alliances that are different from NATO, because there is the sense increasingly in Poland and elsewhere that we are not, as the leading power in NATO, that we are not a reliable ally, and that maybe being a member of NATO does not provide the protection that, you know, the Poles told their people it did. That's dangerous. Putin and Xi and their bot armies have been working to sow discord and dissent and division in the West and in NATO for over a decade now. And if you go back further to KGB stuff, for decades, for generations. It's difficult for me to imagine that the people in charge of those projects aren't looking at the state of NATO and the state of American politics and the state of the Western alliances and not saying, man, we did a good job. And the thing that infuriates me is so many politicians know this. They're just not acting on it. And it's grotesque to me. I finished Slow Horses with my wife last night. I don't know, Pod was saying how the first few episodes were slow, and I heard other people saying it wasn't really as good as it used to be, although a lot of people said the finale was really good. I thought all six episodes were really good. I enjoyed it a lot, and if you've never watched Slow Horses, I highly recommend it. You know, there are now three seasons. I would watch it with the subtitles on, though, because sometimes the British English is kind of hard to follow. I think people know this about me. I am a Walking Dead completist. So I'm into the bitter end. I've watched every single Walking Dead spinoff. You know, Fear the Walking Dead. I watched the Daryl thing. I watched those miniseries with those kids that I was just waiting for them to get eaten by zombies. This new spinoff thing, The Ones Who Live or something like that. And it's basically the story of Rick Grimes and Michonne. Watched the first episode of that, and the fair Jessica was like, yeah, you can watch the rest of this by yourself. And I kind of don't blame her. I mean, man, did they race through a lot of plot development to set up this series. The spinoff that's taking place in New York is okay. The Daryl one in France, I think, is actually really pretty good. And I haven't made up my mind about this one yet, but I'm in it to the end. You know, and at some point I will reprise my whole spiel about how Walking Dead is tracking the sort of Mansur Olson argument about the development of civilization. But we can save that for another time. And some of you probably remember it. And I guess that's it. I'm just so tired and I need to get some rest before the Fair Jessica and I are going to go out tonight. I'm going to see if I can make it. I'm going to reload my pharmaceutical stores. We are going to go see a screening of Fargo, the movie, which obviously I've seen many times, with in-person commentary with William H. Macy, which I think should be pretty fun. I think it's at the Warner Theater or something like that. So we're going to go to that tonight. And I will be, unless I get much sicker, I'll be on the Chris Wallace Show on Saturday. Then next week gets a little complicated. I have a speech. It's a business group, so it's not open to the public in Phoenix. And I turn around and come home, and then I got to go to New York to deal with some business stuff with my mom's estate. I should point out that a week from today is my birthday, so there is time, particularly if you FedEx it, time to send me all sorts of scotch and whatnot. On that, I'll talk to you next time.